thanks for this nice introduction. So today I'll be talking about, I'll try to address this general question of how to understand the onset of equilibrium in quantum many body systems by studying some simple solvable examples. So now before starting, why do we even care about that? So obviously this is a big fundamental question that underpins the validity of our description of everyday life and of our laws of thermodynamics. And so why is everything in equilibrium? And if something is pushed out of equilibrium, how does it get back to the equilibrium? And what are the mechanisms for that? And so, okay, so obviously this is an old question. Many people have thought about it, but still the reason is this is still a question is that it's hard to find a nice and simple answer that would just work in all the contexts. We have many effective ideas why that happens, but still deriving it from first principles is very hard, even if we consider very simple systems. But what I will try to argue today is that conceptually, the cleanest setting where we can try to understand this equilibration is by studying isolated quantum many body systems. So quantum many body systems that are not coupled to environment, but are undergoing some coherent dynamics. Okay, so another question what one might ask is why are we thinking about this now? Since quantum mechanics has been around for almost a century, how come this hasn't been done before? Well, okay, first of all, it's hard. We can't really do it in general. And it's not one of the problems that people in the 30s could just think of and solve. But there is another reason for why we are thinking about these issues now. And it's because this is now the question of how many body systems are equilibrating. So how isolated many body systems equilibrate is now of now recently became of experimental relevance. Because until a few decades ago, when we were thinking about quantum unibody systems, what we had in mind were electrons in solids. So these are the typical, these were the typical quantum unibody systems people were studying. And for all practical purposes, these things are almost always in equilibrium when we measure them. So the reason is that these electrons are strongly interacting with phonons and with all the impurities and so on. So it's very hard to observe some coherent quantum isolated quantum dynamics here. And on top of that, the dynamics here happens on very, very short timescales, and which is again a problem, for experiments. But this situation drastically changed fairly recently due to big experimental advances, which make us able to synthesize artificial quantum materials. So in the laboratory. So these things are, examples of these are cold atoms or trapped ions or some hybrid systems. But the point, the good feature of these systems is that these really are many body systems, or there are many, there is a big number of particles interacting, not an Avogadro number as in solids, but still a rather large number. Their dynamics is up to a very good approximation, very well isolated from the environment. The timescales on which these systems undergo heating are on the order of a tenth of a second, while the dynamical timescales, the typical timescales on which the dynamics happens are lower and are on the range of milliseconds. Okay, as I said today, I want to discuss how these quantum many body systems thermalize. And the outline of the talk is briefly, this is the outline of the talk. Now I tried to very, very briefly motivate why we would be interested in these questions. Then I will go on to discuss our general understanding in a very general setting. And so therefore it's very, it's general, therefore not very concrete, but still. And then I will show how this general picture can be understood in this special setting of quantum circuits. And then I will show you how we can actually find the, I will show you an example of where this thing can be really solved. So, okay, so I understand this is probably very vague at the moment, but I'll get more concrete as it goes on. And then, okay, at the end, we'll just briefly summarize and conclude with some open questions. Okay, so what I have in mind when I'm talking about thermalization is the protocol with which it's the easiest to study thermalization, or maybe the cleanest setting in which we might study it, is the so-called quench protocol. So we assume that the system is initialized in some pure state, some state psi, and then we just let it evolve unitarily. So we let it evolve for according to the Schrödinger equation. So at time t, this will be given by dc to the minus dht on the initial state. So now what is an important point to make here is that we assume that psi is not a simple superposition of eigenstates. So it's not a finite superposition of eigenstates, because in this case, this thing would be just describing some simple oscillations. And so this is not what we have in mind. What we have in mind is when psi is something that is very complicated in the eigenbasis of our Hamiltonian. Okay, good. Okay, I'm having issues with, okay, never mind. Good. So now the question that we now want to ask is, how does this system reach equilibrium? How does this system eventually come to the how can this system be described as an equilibrium system after a while? And this is not obvious, because we know that in equilibrium our system will be described by some statistical ensemble. So this statistical ensemble would be some sort of classical superposition of some states. So it would be a mixed state. Some sort of density matrix describing a mixed state, while our state will be always pure. So this will, due to the unitarity of time evolution, this state will always stay just one quantum state, so pure quantum state. So it is clear that our system will not just be described by itself as by some thermodynamic ensemble. But what does happen is that thermalization happens locally in the sense that, so what we can assume that happens is, so the intuitive picture we have in mind is that even though the full system might be in some pure state, if we're only interested in a subsystem, this subsystem will be the dynamics inside this subsystem will be the same as would be as is the dynamics of a system connected to of a finite system connected to some effective thermal bath. So there would be some dissipation happening due to these interactions with the rest of the system. Okay, now to make this a bit more precise, what I have in mind here is that if I'm only interested in expectation values of observables inside this small subsystem, they will be in the limit of first in the thermodynamic limit and then T to infinity limit, these expectation values will be described by thermal ensembles. So there will be some trace of this density matrix times the observable that I'm interested in. Okay, so now, fine, but now what is this this ensemble to which we relax? So this can be just by assuming that we thermalize, we can immediately find the right ensemble that is describing our equilibrium. And so the way to do it is that first we have to take into account the dynamical constraints. So this Hamiltonian might have some symmetries, and all the observables that the expectation values of the observables that commute with it will be conserved. So they will not change by the time evolution. And now what this means for us is that since we're only interested in the subsystem, what this means is that we have to identify all the conservation laws that can be written as integrals over the space with local densities. So we have to identify all the local all the extensive conservation laws with local densities. with local densities. And then when we have this, when we have this set of conservation laws, we just do constraint maximization of thermodynamic entropy, and then we get one of these kind of nice ensembles. So we have to sum over all the conservation laws, all the extensive conservation laws, and then we have to attach chemical potential to each one of them. This is not hard to believe. This is something we see in statistical physics, so it's not very exotic. And these chemical potentials are determined by expectation values of these densities in the initial state. So because of the translation invariance, what will be conserved will be the density of which each one of these extensive quantities. Now, to give you a few examples of what can happen. So typically, if we are talking about some Hamiltonian dynamics, typically what we expect to happen is that there are no such conservation laws except for the Hamiltonian. And so we would get a Gibbs ensemble. So up to normalization, you have e to the minus beta h describing the thermal density matrix. Then there are, if we are thinking about integrable systems, so this would be, for example, the Heisenberg spin chain, we would get infinitely many extensive conservation laws, and then we would just have to keep the full sum, which would be now infinite, and we would have to identify an infinite number of these chemical potentials. So we would refer to this ensemble as a generalized Gibbs ensemble. And then what can also happen, okay, so then on top of that, it could happen that we have a few conservation laws, right? Okay, let me go back. It can happen that we have only a few conservation laws. For example, we could only conserve energy and magnetization. This could also happen, then our sum would go, would have two terms here. But it can also happen that our time evolution is not Hamiltonian, but it's not given in terms of a time-independent Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian changes with time. So like in Floquet systems an example of this that are Floquet systems. And then in that case, it can very well happen that there are no local conservation laws. And so what happens is our system will relax to the identity, so to the featureless maximally mixed states, also referred to as the infinite temperature state, because it corresponds to beta going to zero, so the inverse temperature going to zero. Okay, so now we know that if this thermalization really happens, we now know how to. I mean, it's not hard to believe that this is how we would describe the system in equilibrium. This is, after all. These are, after all, standard statistical ensembles or variations on them. Now we know how to describe these states at infinite times. But the problem is that we still don't really understand why this thermalization really happens, or if this equilibration happens, and what are the timescales, what are the microscopic mechanisms for that. So. What I said so far had zero predictive power. I mean, we assume that there is an effective path, but where does this path come from, and how do we describe it? And so these are all the questions that we're not able to answer in general. And in particular, they're also not very, these questions are also not, don't have a simple answer, a simple general answer that would work all the time. And indeed, sometimes thermalization just doesn't occur. So what can happen is that we never thermalize. And so a very well-known example of that are quantum antibody scars. So the idea here is that they made an experiment. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, the history of these quantum antibody scars started when there was an experiment showing that for some initial states, there was just no relaxation happening. So there were these persistent oscillations that were never not decaying as fast as they thought they should. And so then they understood that there are these special states, special eigenstates of the Hamiltonian with which the initial state had a large overlap. So this is the overlap with that. These are precisely these black states here. And due to some special properties of these eigenstates, the dynamics was then somehow constrained to some subsector of the Hilbert space. And so I don't really want to go to too much detail, but what I want to say is that it can very well happen that we do not see thermalization the thermalization at all, even though it's not a priori clear that this wouldn't happen here. I mean, they understood later what happens, but it was not clear at the time of the experiment that there should be no thermalization going on. So yeah, so now we need to, if we want to address this question, what we need to do, we need to be able to study the dynamics on non-finance timescales. So this intuitive picture is not enough. We really need to do some, to get some more concrete results. And okay, so to remind you, the regime that I have in mind is really very long times, but is this ordering of limits. So first we have to take the thermodynamic limit and then time to infinity limit. And so this is a hard regime to study. Okay, so at the moment what is understood is that this can be done exactly for non-interacting models. So for integrable, so for like a fermionic quadratic models and stuff and things like that. And in that case, for initial states with short range correlations, it can be shown that that this picture really applies. So it can be shown that the observables relax to the values predicted by these equilibrium ensembles. But if we want to go beyond this non-interacting limit, it's not so easy. And in particular, this is a very hard regime to study numerically. So for two of the most standard approaches one would consider either we are limited to small system sizes, or we are limited to short times. So this is a very hard regime to access numerically. Okay, but then what we can do, what was realized a few years ago that can be done, and it's quite surprising, is that these calculations can be performed exactly in some solvable chaotic models, or in some solvable models that are not really standard integrable models that one would consider. And so the setting that I have in mind is that of local quantum circuits. So now we imagine that our system is like a one-dimensional chain here. So these are my physical sites. So at some time, this is my state here. This would be my state if I drew it. And then time evolution is now, instead of being some Hamiltonian acting on these states, is now described in terms of this discrete time evolution that at each time step only couples together nearest neighbors. So in the first time step, we apply some unitary transformation on the second and third site, and then fourth and fifth site, and then sixth and seventh, and so on. And then in the next time step, we change the parity. And so, yeah, so after, So this might seem a bit artificial, and it's not obvious, I mean, depending on where you come from, but if you are a condensed matter theorist and you are used to think about Hamiltonians, this is a bit, this doesn't really necessarily look very natural. But then on the other hand, this kind of circuits also can also arbitrarily, can also approximate the Hamiltonian dynamics arbitrarily well, if we just take the time step small enough. So, it's not so artificial after all. Okay, so why am I talking about circuits? So because in the last years, a few subclasses of these quantum circuits were found to be exactly soluble. So in particular, the two of those, there are two of those. One is this random unitary models, where each one of these small gates is a random unitary matrix, or dual unitary, where each one of these unitary matrices here has some special symmetry under the exchange of space and time. And yes, in these models, also these questions of thermalization can be asked. But the problem is that in that case, the subsystem dynamics, so the dynamics that we obtain at the end, is very, very non-generic. So what I mean by that is that everything thermalizes immediately in one time step. There is no... slow relaxation, no exponential or power, or there is no time associated with this thermalization, but it just happens instantly. And so this is not what we expect to actually happen in general. So we need other ideas. Well, we need other models that we can solve in this way. And so yeah. So what I will talk about today is this recent example that we found with Bruno Bertini, who was in Oxford but now recently moved to Nottingham, and Lorenzo Piroli that was at the time in at Max Planck in Munich, but now he moved to ENS in Paris. So yeah, so what we found was this soluble circuit where these dynamical properties are more generic. So in particular, they decay exponentially and don't just thermalize immediately. Okay, now before I get to this precise model, let me first discuss these ideas of this effective bath a bit more generally in a quantum circuit. Okay, so what I have in mind by the quantum circuit now is slightly different from what I had before. And in particular, I am assuming that my time evolution can be given in terms of these matrix product operators. So I have this U even and U odd, that each one of them consists of these staggered tensors, where the staggered tensor, there are two of them. One is the big circle and one is the small circle. And I require that the small circle forces all these incoming legs to be in the same state. So the same state where a state of each one of these legs is acuted. So it goes from zero to d minus one. And the big circle here is just, for now, we can just imagine it to be some functions, to just be something. So each one of these configurations of these legs will give us some number here. On top of that, I also require U even and U odd to be unitary, because I'm ultimately thinking about unitary dynamics. And as I said, this diagram here looks slightly different from the quantum circuit I was showing in the previous slide. But I chose it for convenience because this is how we represent our model. But what I'm saying can be at least the first part can be really rephrased for standard quantum circuits very easily. It's just that one has to stick to a convention. So I chose that one for later convenience. Okay, so now we want to study relaxation. What we want to understand is what is the expectation value of a local observable of an observable at some time t. And so this is now my tensor network that represents my expectation value. So in particular, what I have here, I start with some state. So this is my initial state psi, then that I assume to be in this staggered product form for simplicity. Then I propagate it in time for t time steps. So this is this green part here. Then I have this observable here in the middle. And then I have to multiply this bottom half from the left with the bra part of it. So to do that, I define these red tensors that are just the Hermitian conjugate of the green ones. And then on top, I have to also multiply it by the bra of the initial state. So yeah, so this is now just my expectation value. Now I do this simple transformation of folding. So what I do is I take the top part and I just bend it behind the bottom part, and I get this doubled tensor network here. And I can now assume that I just smash these two layers together and define the new set of tensors that act on this double space. So now each one of these thicker legs consists of two physical spaces, two local physical spaces. So if this one is a qudit, then this is two qudits. Then I have to introduce these gray circles that are just representing the identity. So these gray circles are forcing both of these legs to be in the same state, because here this really is just the same leg, just bent. Then I introduced these orange right and left pointing triangles to represent this product of initial state of the local initial state. Then also my observable now becomes a vector in this double space. And these blue tensors are just just two copies of the tensors from, so it's like a product of these two copies of the forward and backward time evolution tensors together. Okay, so now this is my expectation value at time t. But so the way I built this network was to start from the initial state here at the bottom and then just applying time evolution and then putting an observable at an appropriate point. But equivalently, we could represent, we could understand this network as propagation in space. So what I mean by that is I can define this W tilde here, so that one that has two identities at the top. And then I can also define this W tilde that depends on the precise operator that I put here. And now in terms of these two transfer matrices, these two space transfer matrices or transverse transfer matrices, I can rewrite this expectation value as a trace of n minus one powers of this one and then one of those. So now this is my expectation value at time t. But now we see that when we go to the thermodynamic limit, the important thing that will dominate this n minus one power of the transfer matrix are its spectral properties. And in particular, one can show that for any local unitary dynamics, this matrix only has one eigenvalue different from zero, which is one. And also one can show that it might have three Jordan blocks with trivial structure on the diagonal, so with zeros on the diagonal. But then what this means is that when n goes to infinity, I can now replace this by just the left and right eigenvector. So if I introduce left eigenvector, if I introduce this bra L for the left eigenvector and ket R for the right eigenvector, then my expectation value at time t will be just given as this matrix element of the transfer matrix that has the operator dependence sandwiched between the left and right eigenvectors or fixed points of the transfer matrix. I think I forgot to put tilde here, so I'm sorry, it's a typo. Okay, but now equivalently, if we now return to this graphical representation, we can see that now we introduced these two objects, L and R, that can just replace the rest of the system. So what we get is we get this one transfer matrix here, and then L and R on the left and on the right. And okay, so this idea is more general. This idea also applies for any observable, for any local observable, for any local observable with any local support. So in particular, this also implies that I can just rewrite my reduced density matrix on a finite subsystem S as this left fixed point here on the left, right fixed point here on the right. And then in the middle, we have this same unitary dynamics as before. Locally, the dynamics is the same as before here. We just have this interaction with the left and right, with these two objects. But this is now precisely this effective bath idea that I started with. So now we have this, the effect of the rest of the system on the finite subsystem is now fully determined by these fixed points, which means that these fixed points are actually this effective bath through which our system relaxes. And now this works always. I mean, this always works as long as we have local circuit dynamics. But the problem is that to be able to go, I mean, I can always draw this diagram, but I still need to be able to determine this L and R. And this is where the problems start. So in particular, as one might expect, I think I heard something. Okay, never mind. And so in particular, as one might expect, the complexity, the computational complexity of obtaining these left and right fixed points generically grows exponentially with t. So here I'm showing an example. So here I copied an example showing that where there were, so this is entropy. So what they're doing is they are assuming that one of these fixed points is they're interpreting one of these fixed points as a quantum state on this temporal lattice. And then the complexity of the state would be given by its entanglement entropy. And so this entanglement entropy grows linearly, which means that the computational complexity of obtaining this object grows exponentially with time. So in general, we can't say much more than that, at least up to now. I mean, for a general system at the moment, we can't say much more than just that. However, in our example, so in this example that I will show you now, these fixed points, left and right fixed points, are take a very simple matrix product state form with a finite bond dimension. So this means that I am able to encode these two fixed points with really a small amount of information. Okay, so now. Before showing how to get there, let me spend a few minutes on introducing the model, since it's not one of the famous ones that people typically hear about. In particular, it's this Rule 54 cellular automaton that was introduced in this paper almost this CMP almost 30 years ago. And it is, and recently we understood that it is probably the simplest interacting model one can imagine. So it became very popular because it's possible to use it to compute some out of equilibrium objects, both in the classical and quantum setting, that are typically not accessible for other integrable interacting models. And what I wanted to do now is just quickly advertise this nice recent review that that we wrote this year. So here we are mostly covering the classical side of the story, not so much the quantum one. Okay, so this model is defined on a one-dimensional binary lattice. So I'm imagining my configuration to live on this saw-like shaped lattice, and each side is either full or empty, or is either zero or one. And now time evolution, in each step of the time evolution, only half of the sides get updated, and in particular, the ones that are positioned at the bottom. So the way the time evolution works is I get a configuration on these three sides here and find a new configuration for the middle one. Then I go for the next, and I find the new configuration of the middle one of the next triple of sides, and then so on. And then in one time step, we get from this parity of the lattice to that parity of the lattice. And now we just repeat the same thing, only we shift everything by one side. So now I'm applying my time evolution map on these three sides to find a new value here, and then these three sides, also one on the left to find one here, and so on. And time evolution is given in terms of this function here. So it's just, it's a binary function. So it's a function that maps a configuration on three sides to a configuration on one side deterministically. And it can be graphically nicely represented by these diagrams here at the bottom. So for each three side configuration, we find a unique way to update the middle side. So 0, 0, 0, for 0, 0, 0, we would get 0. For 0, 0, 1, we would get 1. 0, 1, 0, we would get 1, and so on. And now, the dynamics has a very simple interpretation, so which is, I think, nicely explained if we look at an example. So here at the bottom, I start with this sort of random configuration. So I choose this configuration at the bottom and then just apply these time evolution rules for a few time steps. And then what I'm interested in is, what I'm interested in is what is the configuration of at some later side, later time. And we see that what happens is that these full sides behave as some sort of particles. So there is this particle here that is moving with some fixed velocity, and then it's encountering another particle that is moving in the opposite direction. These two particles scatter, so they interact pairwise. They first annihilate and then they reappear in the next time step, and then they continue. And now if I'm just following a trajectory of one of these particles, I will see that what this interaction does is it shifts it back in time. So it delays the particle. So this particle would we would continue on this trajectory if there was no other particle around him, but due to the scattering, it gets displaced. And so he's moved two sides to the back. So he gets delayed for two sides. Okay, so so this is our model. But now this model can be also interpreted as a quantum model. We just assume that these cellular automaton rules are describing the dynamics of computational basis states. And so now I can go back to my initial tensor network, and I can identify that if I can identify the right tensors that will give me my dynamics. And in particular, this big circle. If I define the elements of these big circles as delta between this configuration here at the bottom and between the state at the top and updated value if I had this configuration on these three sides, then I just get the right dynamics. So this is now this now completely specifies the dynamics. And now what I wanted to do is I wanted to find the fixed points of this. I wanted to find these fixed points of this transverse transfer matrix. So to refresh our memory, what these blue tensors are, these tensors defined on the doubled space. So they are these two products of these two tensors. So now this big light gray circle will be just a product of two delta functions. The small one will be just forcing both legs in both copies to be in the same. So legs to be the same in both copies. So like this. And now, as I said before, this gray circle here is just forcing both legs to be in the same state. So this one is coupling the two copies together, while all the others are just products in the two copies. Okay, and so now the way we will find these fixed points is by following a two-step procedure. First, we start by making a detour and we study a related matrix, but not the same we started with. So our transfer matrix has this initial state here at the bottom, but that is a pure quantum that represents a pure quantum state. But now, still here at the bottom, we start with this. With these identities. So this one for just comes from the normalization. Okay, so first let us try to find fixed points of this object. And so my claim is that, so what we do is we introduce this one and two side tensors. So this diamond and square tensors that have this one physical space legs that corresponds to two qubits. And then we have this auxiliary space in the vertical direction. And then there is another, there is a two-side tensor that acts on two physical sides, but then it has this vertical, it has this one vertical auxiliary space. It's a matrix in this auxiliary space. And then also we need to define this flipped T, which is the boundary vector, which only acts on the auxiliary space and not on the physical one. Okay, and now my claim is that if this set of algebraic relations is fulfilled, so if these dark blue tensors together with the light blue tensors satisfy this set of algebraic relations, then I can construct my fixed points. And I can show it quite nice. And this can be quite nicely understood. So what we started, what I mean by that is I assume that my left fixed point of the infinite temperature transfer matrix. So this left fixed point is made out of this staggered, consists of these tensors staggered in the vertical direction. So it's a square, diamond, and so on. Now, my claim is that this will just is the same as this. So my claim is that this left bra left infinity with the infinite temperature transfer matrix will give me a bra L infinity. Okay, now this can be nicely shown. So what we start with, we start here in the bottom left corner, and we see that if we use the first relation, what will happen is we will remove these two tensors and make a two-side tensor here. We will obtain one factor of two, and also we will remove this light blue tensor here together with this identity. And now we now continue with other relations, in particular with the second one, where we see that if we apply it here, what will happen is we will move this two-side tensor upwards, and at the same time we will remove the gray one. And so this happens, and we repeat this until we get to the top, where we have to absorb the two-side tensor at the top. And so now what we did we removed half of this transfer matrix, so one column of this transfer matrix, and by doing that we flipped the parity, the positions, exchanged positions of squares and diamonds here, and also we removed one factor of one half from here. And now now we repeat exactly the same procedure, only in the second step, we have to modify the initial the initial step and the last step. So now our our boundary relation at the bottom will be slightly different because we're starting with a slightly different situation that we started before. And so by doing this, we obtain back this L infinity. And now we can do an analogous thing also for the right fixed point. We just need to require another set of relations that is transposed with respect to this one. So we also need that if I flip each one of these diagrams, left, right, if I flip each one of these diagrams, then I will just get, then this or they also have to be satisfied, and then I can find this right fixed. Good, but obviously this all depends on the fact that I can find some tensors that satisfy this, right? Because now this is very diagrammatic, and it's not obvious that these tensors even exist. But in our case, we find a solution can be written in terms of 3x3 matrices. So these objects here are quite simple for us in our case. Okay, now we go to the second step. And in this second step, now we use this insight that we got from solving for this infinite temperature state, and now we try to find some initial states for which we can do the same thing. And so what we do is we make this ansatz where left and right fixed points are the same as before, only the bottom vector changes. So this bottom auxiliary space vector changes. And now my claim is that if I require these two relations here on the right to hold, then this L and R will be my fixed points for this transfer matrix that we started with. So for this transfer matrix that starts with some initial pure quantum state, and not the one where we already have some terminal ensemble here. Okay, and so we can now try to, using the information that we have from before, because now we know now we know everything except for this bottommost line in both of these relations. So now we can solve for these two. And in particular, we find a solution where we find a product state solution where on one side, we have an equal superposition of zeros and ones, up to some non-trivial phase that we can also put in. And then on the other side, we only have the state zero. So yeah, so now we have a well-defined quantum initial state for which we're able to find, so we have a family due to these phases of dissolving initial states for which we are able to find find left and right fixed points. Okay. But so now that this is done, let's go now back to our physics that we started with. So what can now we say, we say now about this thermalization? And so let's try to again go back to the expectation value of some local observable, which is now described here with this tensor network. And I immediately see that I can understand this thing can be computed for arbitrarily large t if only I know the spectrum of this cx here. So so what I want to say is that this tensor network here can be equally understood as this state here that depends on the initial state, and then t applications of this cx matrix here that combines two auxiliary spaces and then x physical spaces here. And then on the top, we have to then multiply it from the left with this top state that depends on the observable. And now my claim is that, if we are interested at some finite t, at the expectation value at some finite t or any t, the only thing we need to know is spectral properties of this matrix here, so of this C of x. And so now, obviously, this thing is growing with the support. So the size of this matrix is growing exponentially with the support, but it does not depend on the on time. So now our expectation values are exponentially costly in support instead of time. So it's much better than before. So if our support of the observables is very small, this is basically for almost for free. So it's, I don't know, if the support is here too, we have 16 times 9 dimensional matrix. So it's not so bad. But actually we can say more. So if we can even just keep support as big as possible, as large as we want, but we assume that the times that we're interested in are much larger, or in actually we're only interested in the asymptotic behavior. Then what we can do is we can now again apply this algebraic relations from before, and we end up with this sort of structure here at the top that whose depth changes with support. So this grows linearly with support, but does not depend on time. And here at the bottom, we just have t minus 3x over 4 application of this C0 that doesn't have any physical legs. So this is a 9 by 9 matrix. And so this one we can diagonalize, and then we can see that if time is big enough, so asymptotically when t goes to infinity while x is kept fixed, we can now show that expectation values of all local observables will be exponentially close to exponentially close to expectation values in the infinite temperature state, so in the state in the maximum mixed state, in the featureless state. And now this characteristic time here is 1 over 2 log 2, but what is important here is that it's positive, so that this thing really exponentially decays. Okay, so now we know how to, in our specific case, we now know how to treat thermalization, but this idea of the space-time duality is a bit more general and has been applied for various different objects ranging from quantum many-body chaos. People have used it to gain some additional insight to this measurement in induced phase transitions, and they have studied quantum dynamics, which is what we are doing here also. This approach is a bit more general, and I can now just briefly show how this can be also done for entanglement entropy, to understand entanglement entropy. In particular, let us consider the entanglement entropy of the bipartition of the system in two halves, and then we will take the system size to infinity. So now I go back to the unfolded picture of before, so the one that we started with. So what we have an initial state here, and then we have this forward time evolution, and we have the complex conjugate of the initial state, and then this backward time evolution here. And then we have to trace over half of the system, which is represented by these hooks here. So now we are coupling this one together with this one, and so on. So we're summing over all those. And now if we want to know what is the, so to express the entanglement entropy, the mth Rényi entanglement entropy, in what we need to do is we need to be able to express traces of powers of this object here. And so this can be visualized very schematically, approximately like that. So what I'm doing here is now I'm taking, so what I do here is I take this object here, then I bend the bottom one behind the top one, and then I keep this connection here. So this connection here corresponds to tracing over. So, and now for the mth entanglement entropy, I need m such pairs of time sheets, so m such structures. So here I have three, so I have 1, 2, 3 of them. And now I have to multiply them. And the way I multiply them, I multiply this this empty leg, this free legs of the backward time evolution of the first copy. I multiply them with the forward time evolution of forward time evolution free legs of the second copy, and then backward time evolution of the second copy. I connect with the third time evolution. So forward time evolution of the third copy, and then at the end I have to trace over. So what I will get generically is some sort of, I have many stacked copies of these timesheets, and then I just have to connect them in this sort of weird way. So so half of them like that, and so on half of the system like that, and then the same works in the second half. I just displace it by one like that, and now I can again. Now, if I want to go into the thermodynamic limit where both of these left and right halves are going to infinity, so the sizes of both left and right halves are going to infinity, I can again use the same ideas of before, because I can identify this sort of band here as precisely my transfer matrix from before. So this is really the same transfer matrix that we had before, only now we have we wrote it in an unfolded way. And so now, so this is true. So then in the thermodynamic limit, instead of this big half infinite array of these transfer matrices, I will just get the left fixed point, and then the same thing will be here true on the right, but I will get the right fixed point, and I will couple together different copies. And then with a bit of imagination, one can see that when the system size goes to infinity, we will get this sort of, we will be able to represent this thing equivalently with this sort of the tensor network of the size 2m times 2t, where now these dark blue tensors are precisely the same tensors as before, only now they are unfolded. So what I mean is now they have the two legs, and each one of these physical space legs only corresponds to one qubit, while before there were two of them together. And now in our case, in principle can be done always. Only one would be coupling together very complicated objects here. But in our case, since these tensors are very, very simple, we can now study this tensor network here. And in particular, we're able to show what is the rate of entanglement growth for large sizes, for large times. So what is the asymptotic rate of entanglement growth? Okay. So at this point, let me summarize briefly. So what I wanted to argue today is that, first of all, these local quantum circuits in general are very convenient to address questions regarding relaxation. And so I'm just putting another reference where this was done in another system, but still with the same ideas as the ones I was trying to show today. And then the second part, so the second thing I want you to remember is that in our case, we can find a very simple matrix product state description for this effective path. So in our case, we can really study this emergence of thermalization in this way. Now, okay, so let me just conclude with some open questions. So first of all, here I was talking about the infinite temperature state, but this can be extended to slightly richer. One would like to extend it. Oh, I'm sorry, there is a typo here. So there is e to the e here missing. But yeah, so one would like to extend this to richer stationary state, and in particular, we already know that that we can do this for this sort of simple Gibbs ensembles or generalized Gibbs ensembles where we add two chemical potentials corresponding to the number of left and right movers. But it would be nice to understand how this happens for more conservation laws, because our model is integrable, so it has an infinite number of conservation laws. And in particular, we could in principle here have the infinite sum, or at least a finite sum with more terms. And so it would be interesting to understand how this complexity of the stationary state affects the complexity of this MPS in these fixed points. Then what would be, what is probably the most important question is, can this be extended? So can we extend these same ideas to find solutions to other models? And I mean, unfortunately, typically, there are not many solvable models around, so one must be a bit lucky to find to stumble upon one. But at least in this case, we know that there are a few others. So in particular, I have some results showing that one can study a similar cellular automaton that was proposed in these two references here. So there are at least a few examples of there are at least a few, where a few is larger than one, examples of systems where this can be done. And then another question is if these algebraic relations can be also used somehow approximatively. So now if we don't, if we assume that these are not exactly fulfilled, but they are fulfilled up to some small corrections, does this give us any information on our dynamics? And so, and it's not really obvious how, if there is any way to make it work, but it would be, I think, very cool to do. Okay, so at this point I will stop and thank you for your attention.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Katya.
Let me just turn on the light.
Okay. And in the meantime, I'll just ask if there are any questions from students first. Anna?
Yeah, thank you for the talk. I guess linking onto these algebraic relations, from the point where you said we know matrices that fulfill these algebraic relations exist in the 3x3 case, from that point onwards, I was just wondering, do you show this existence by using matrices, or do you remain in this tensor network language, or do you fall back onto normal matrices?
Well, I mean, I can show you the matrices. I don't know if they're very. But yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is that. So what these tensors are, these matrices are just components of the physical space components of these tensors. So if I fix the physical space information, then I know what these are. Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have probably prepared this thing before, but this is, this one. Okay, So these are the matrices now. I don't know if they're not very informative, but I think they're, what is nice about them is that they're very, very simple. So there is nothing magical about them. So it's that thing. Obviously there are some gauge invariances. So there is some gauge invariance over how to write them out. And this is an interesting thing to try to understand. But apart from that, So these are now these components. So what I mean, if now both physical space legs are in the state zero, then my A matrix, which is, so I think A is the diamond and B is the square here. So it will be this sort of 3x3 matrix here. And then so on. So these are all of them.
No, sorry. Right. Okay. So it's basically matrix language full.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, at the end of the day, when you want to diagonalize this thing here, you need to know what, you need to represent it as something. So you really need to know what these matrices are. One needs to somehow specify these tensors, is what I'm saying.
Any other questions from students? If not, let me open it up to more general questions.
I have a question.
Go for it.
So what's the key feature of your model that enables you to solve it exactly?
Yeah, it's not immediately obvious. Well, I can give you a bit of a backward answer to that. So what one can show is that being able to solve it exactly in this precise way means that I am able to, it means that when I'm looking at two-point correlation functions in my model, so if I have some density at time zero and position zero times density at time t position x, so this means that the correlations inside the, there will be these two light cones to the problem. So one is the velocity one, so this is this causal light cone, so if this correlation don't spread too fast, but also there is a smaller light cone. So there is a smaller the smaller light cone inside which all correlations will decay exponentially. And if you don't have this feature, then and in particular the speed of this light cone is 1/3 in appropriate units. One can show that if you don't have this inner light cone inside which the correlations must decay exponentially, then this sort of treatment is not possible. But I think it's a good question of why this is solvable, because I with this cellular automata, I mean, I know a few examples and a few different solutions, and it often seems that if you're able to solve for quantity A in one of the models, in both of the models, it's not clear that you will then be able to solve for the quantity B in both of them. Maybe you can only solve in one or the other. So this exact solvability of this kind of models is still a very much open question. So, I mean, it's not very well understood.
Uh-huh. Maybe let me just ask a few related questions. So is your method specific to 1+1D?
Yeah, okay. So now in particular, there is no good way to, I don't have a good reason to say that you can't do it in more than 1D, but because in principle, these things can be defined in, for example, two dimensions or three plus one, right? I mean, these things can always be defined, but I think that this sort of, I don't know. I mean, I don't think this is possible in more than 1D. And the reason why I think so is that this is an integrable model, an integrable interacting model. And so far, at least for the typical integrable interacting model, there is no example in more than 1D. So I would, if I had to bet, this is what I would bet on, but I'm not sure I have any good argument for that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So what's the precise, you mentioned the connection between your model and the old paper 30 years ago about cellular automata.
Yeah.
And is the connection just your tensor satisfies that rule?
No, so actually this is precisely that model. So this is precisely the model that I'm considering. And so now, this model is precisely the one that was defined back then, but the way they were studying this model was really to stay at the level of these trajectories. So they were solving it in terms of that, but actually the reason why people started to be interested in that model recently is that you can now also, instead of just be satisfied by looking at these trajectories, one can also do some statistical physics of that. So either classical or quantum. So we can understand that. So we can now, if we imagine that this is now some quantum dynamics, so that this is just dynamics in a special, basis. So if this is just the dynamics of the computational basis states, which is deterministic, which is a special property. I mean, it's not, which is very very non-generic, right? But still, we can still say that if this is the dynamics in this sort of computational basis, then I can still do, I can still now define this unitary operator and then just pretend it's quantum and see what happens. And so this is basically how you get here, right? So you just rewrite this in terms of this quantum operator, and then you express it in terms of these tensors.
Mm-hmm. But there are many similar automata models, I think, in that paper. And where did you pick up this one?
But in that particular paper, it's just is this one and some other one, which is defined in a weird, in some sort of a weird space. So this one has two examples. So the reason why I chose this one is, the other one is a bit, is in some sort of like a finite field. Of a weird finite field. So it's not just like Z2, it's something else. So this is mostly why, because this one is much easier to deal with. And also, I think that some of my colleagues were trying to understand if they can use the second automaton of this paper to understand, to do some statistical mechanics, but then it's very hard to define distributions on top of that, because it's not very, I don't really remember the details. But yes, what maybe I should stress is that this rule 54 is the naming coming from Wolfram, from these ideas in the 80s. But the way the time evolution works is different. So for in the Wolfram's language, what one would do, one would apply this thing on all sides at the same time, so simultaneously. But what we want to do here is really some sort of something that we would consider local. So what we need to do, we need to split it in two time steps. So this is not the same model as the as what people might know as rule 54 from this classification of Wolfram from the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, maybe time for one more question if there is one, or is there one? If not, then let's thank Katya one last time for a great talk.